Good morning, Nexus. I'm so glad you're with us this morning, and I want to start by sharing with you an email that I received a few weeks ago. It went this way. I've been having a few conversations with friends on relationships where one person is really involved in their faith and identifies as a Christian, and the other is not. I think this is really relevant for young adults, especially as they consider making big relationship choices and how that plays into faith development, what that will eventually look like for raising kids, etc. I'd love to think about this through a biblical lens, considering passages on marital union, etc. Just thought I'd pass that along as an area of interest in case it could fit somewhere. Now, I love the idea. My guess is this person isn't the only one with marriage questions perhaps on their mind right around now, and I promise by the end of this morning, I want to specifically address that big question, who should I marry? But in thinking about that question, I think a larger question looms behind it. What is marriage for? Well, let's explore that, because I think the big takeaway from Scripture is that marriage is not an end to itself. And I want to piece together how someone like Paul develops this idea. You see, in Scripture, 1 Corinthians 7 is probably the most detailed look we have at marriage, and two things immediately jump to mind when you read through 1 Corinthians 7. First, how shockingly egalitarian it is, but second, how bizarre it is. The whole thing's very confusing if you just read through it, and there's a reason for that. You see, Paul is writing to the hot mess that is the Corinthian church. There were so many problems in this church, it's just kind of mind-boggling. And of course, one of the contentious issues was sex. And there's two groups pitted against each other in this church, two groups with radically different ideas around sex and marriage. The first group I like to sort of refer to as the Green New Deal of sexuality. Of course, I'm playing with some side stereotypes here, but as the Green New Deal sort of asked us to put a radical end to our dependence on oil, this group was doing the same thing except with sex. And their argument in the church was essentially this: no one should have sex with anyone ever. In fact, they went so far as to suggest that already married couples should stop having sex. Sex was this earthly distraction, so we all need to stop. Sounds like a real fun group of people, eh? And this is Paul's response to them. Now, to the unmarried and the widows, I say it is good for them to stay unmarried, as I do, but if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it's better to marry than to burn with passion. If you do marry, you haven't sinned, and if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. And this is where we can start to sort of put the puzzle of marriage together according to Paul. You see, Paul is making two big points here. First, he saw singleness as the most advantageous position to be in. And why? Well, for Paul, the church is about becoming a new humanity. The church community was central to how we live out the Jesus path. So church community is actually what's central. For Paul, marriage, family, kids, these things, they just kind of divide where we can spend our energy. And I'll tell you, we've been reminded of that during this lockdown, right? My goodness, when my kids were home or school, I had no energy for anything else except for getting through the day with them. I was completely useless while they're at our home. And this is exactly what Paul's getting at. If you're married, if you've got kids, you've got so many competing loyalties. You don't have a lot of time to give to the community. The amount of energy you can give beyond yourself when you're married with kids, it's minimal. But there's something deeper here as well going on. You see, Paul is confronting an assumption that we have. Then, as it is today, the nuclear family, right, is seen as the cornerstone of society, you could say. Families matter most. And Paul is radically challenging that idea. On the Christian path, biological family does not matter first. In fact, it's part of the problem. And the Jesus path confronts that. Within the church, the couple, the nuclear family, the biological family, they're not the primary thing. You see, for Paul, community was the main thing, and yet Paul was also, of course, a pastor, and he's dealing with real solutions. He's not an idealist. He's giving them practical solutions. And so to these anti-sex people, Paul has a piece of very practical advice for them. Marriage is a practical solution for our sexuality. For him, it's an outlet for our sexual appetites. To put it crudely, we get married because we have a libido. And marriage is the best container for our sexual desires. And so for Paul, it was like, hey, the Christian path doesn't celebrate family or the couple as the chief thing or above everything else. Church community is the main thing. However, he's like, if you're the kind of person who likes the sex, you should probably get married. But that's just the first group in the church. The second group is like the exact opposite of the first group. This group, they thought that their freedom in Jesus, the freedom of the Christian path, meant that there should be no boundaries to sexuality. Essentially, I like to think of these progressives as the sort of libertarians of the sexual world. Sex with anyone and everyone. And what they wanted essentially was a deregulated sexual marketplace where there are no rules and everyone's allowed to express their sexuality in any way they choose. See, but what Paul knew is this, is that deregulated marketplaces lead to what? Monopolies. And so Paul knew that the sexual path these people were traveling down, it was ripe for a Jeff Bezos-like person to come up and set up his Amazon empire. In fact, this seems to be happening directly in the Corinth church, and it's being celebrated. This is what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5. It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and of a kind that even pagans do not tolerate. A man is sleeping with his father's wife, and you're proud? You see, this guy in the church is doing what always happens when there's an unregulated market. This guy's taking more than his fair share. And not only that, he's bragging about it. He's like giving his testimonial on a Sunday morning. I'm so liberated sexually, I've begun sleeping with other people's wives, including my father's. And the liberal crowd is all like, testify, yes, good job, good for you. See how progressive we are? But again, Paul meets them where they're at, and he challenges some of their slogans. So one of the things we could see in 1 Corinthians 6 that the people there would say are, all things are lawful for me. But Paul replies, but all things are not helpful. Yes, but all things are lawful for me. But I will not be brought under the power of any. Paul picks up on this in a later letter, a letter to the church in Galatia. He says, you, my brothers and sisters, you were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another humbly in love. For the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. Notice again here how Paul pushes priorities. The main thing is serving the community. And into this mix, there's one group who's for no sex, the other group for as much sex as possible. And Paul suggests essentially what I like to think of as a socialistic, communistic framework, you could say, around sexuality. If you think of it that way, what Paul is essentially saying is, look, the most equitable and just approach to dealing with our sexuality is to mandate that everyone gets just one sexual partner. Everybody gets one. That way we don't end up with sexual monopolies or people who can't control themselves because we've outlawed sex. Now, I took us down that path to remind us and point out that for Paul, marriage was about dealing with the practicalities of our sexuality. Our sexuality is a part of us and we need containers, you could say, to deal with that. But again, for Paul, it wasn't the primary thing. For Paul, the primary thing is church community, this new community coming together, people who have no biological or ideological connections coming together and sharing around the table, around Jesus' path. And this is the primary thing for Paul, and he's directly challenging the dominant narrative of marriage and family and couples being the nucleus of society. Paul says, now that the church is here, things have changed. And so for Paul, the question is not how can church serve couples or marriages or families, but rather how can couples, marriages, families serve and support the church? And this is a radical reframing, and I want to illustrate for us what I think this kind of looks like. So consider this. Let's say this church here, Nexus, is like a hockey team. And of course, as a hockey team together, our goal is to play in the league of love, you could say, to practice and play out love. Now, in this analogy, marriage is like having a special, practice partner that you spend a lot of time with working on your skills. So we, Nexus, are the team, but someone like Kristen and I, we could decide, right, we want to be special practice partners. And so during the week, you know, we've got our own little ice pad in the back or whatever. We work on stick handling, drills about putting the puck in the net. We practice our hip checking, stuff like that. We practice together, the two of us. And in practicing, we learn a lot. We learn how to play hockey better. But in practicing hockey together on our own, the goal isn't just to be really good at passing to one another. The goal of us practicing together is so that we can bring our skills back to the team. Now, substitute hockey for love. In marriage, we practice learning to love. We practice love not as an end in itself, but so that we can bring our skills back to the team, back to the community. As a Jesus Path person, my goal is to learn to love in the laboratory that is community, the church. For us, this is our lab, Nexus. But the entire point of this community is to learn love via Jesus' path. And marriage then is where we practice love so that we can apply it here, more broadly in the community. Well, what does that look like? Well, here are some easy ones. First, I need to be present. In my relationship with Kristen in marriage, part of learning love is knowing I need to be available. I need to show up. I need to give her my time and attention. I need to be present. And it's the same in community. We bring that skill from marriage into how we deal with others in the community. We show up, we're present. Or I've learned in love, right, that I don't always need to be a problem solver, right? Sometimes the best way to love someone is just to listen. I've recognized that, even if I struggle that with Kristen, right? But it's the same in community. We bring that skill and go, you know what? I don't always have to problem solve. Maybe my role here is to just listen. Or consider this, let the small things go. I can't tell you, there's a host of things that annoy me about Kristen and the kids, and I'm sure it's the same vice versa. But what you learn in marriage is that with love, a lot of times you just have to let those small things go. There's going to be things that just aren't worth fighting over. And it's the same in community. In any community, there's going to be a ton of things that annoy us about other people. And a lot of times what we simply need to learn is to let those things go. They're not worth fighting over. Or shared duties, you know, Kristen's been very busy with school and online, and now it's back to, you know, being in person. And it's like there are times you learn in a love relationship and marriage, there's ebbs and flows where you need to take more on than the other person, or maybe there's times when the other needs to take more on. And it's the same in community. We take those skills we learn in marriage and realize sometimes in community, I'm going to have to step up and do more. Other times, someone else is going to have to do that. Everything I learn about love in marriage is not an end in itself. It's a learning to be applied more broadly. And we bring our learnings into the context of community. Marriage is about learning to love in an intimate setting. And what we learn about love there, we bring to the community. This is the Christian path goal. Marriage is no end, but a training ground for how to love well in community. And I know this is a long way to sort of get to the question of who should I marry in the first place, but I wanted to create a vision for marriage because I think it gives us a filter to see potential partners through. But to directly answer the question, can one, should one marry someone who doesn't share our faith? Well, let's head to the text that everyone fears. 2 Corinthians 6, same church Paul is writing to in 1 Corinthians, and he says this, "Do not be yoked together with unbelievers." There it is, we think, right? Christians shouldn't marry non-Christians. But what's going on? Remember, Paul is referencing a farming metaphor here that we find in Deuteronomy 22, which says this, "You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together." And the idea, right, is of course, if you put an ox and a donkey together, it's going to be trouble. The ox is going to overpower the donkey and the donkey might be stubborn. Your field is going to look like a mess if you put these two together. But the question is this, is Paul applying this idea to marriage? Consider John Calvin's approach. Many are of the opinion that he, Paul, speaks of marriage, but the context clearly shows that they are mistaken. When, therefore, he prohibits us from having partnership with unbelievers in drawing the same yoke, he means simply this, that we should have no fellowship with them in their pollution. To be yoked with unbelievers means nothing less than to have fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness and to hold out the hand to them in token of agreement. What Paul is getting at is intentionally joining, yoking ourselves with something that's polluting. And I really don't think this is hard to understand. It's as simple as this. Consider this. Downtown, there's a number of these money marts or payday loan companies. I think you know what I'm talking about. And these companies exist to do what? They prey on the poor. Essentially, it's robbery what they're doing. So the question is, let's say you and a friend comes and says, hey, why don't we open our own franchise, a money mart? It's like, should a Jesus Path person do that? I'm thinking probably not. Don't yoke yourself to something that's intentionally harmful, polluting. Easy enough to understand, and yet this passage has been applied strictly to marriage and it's had really harmful results. This isn't directly about marriage, so we can relax a little bit. And yet, when we do relax, once we can set that aside, there is some wisdom here that I think we can apply to marriage. Because you see, I think what Paul and Deuteronomy 22 are concerned with here is an imbalance in power and purpose. Just because this isn't directly about marriage, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have any wisdom to offer us. To the contrary, it does. Unequally yoked is definitely something to consider in marriage. Do both parties have the same power and purpose? I mean, consider a couple that I knew. When they got married, both of them were adamant. I want to have kids. I do not want to have kids. They knew this and they still got married. 5 years down the road, this is a real, real tension for them. They just kind of assumed the other would sort of change their mind. That's the kind of thing you probably want to consider before marriage. Do we have the same purpose here? Are we yoked in the same way together? You see, in marriage, there has to be a balance of power and purpose. And so to answer the question directly, if your faith is important to you, should you marry someone who isn't a Christian? The answer is, of course, to me, well, that depends on the person. But let me illustrate what I think are the bare minimum in any marriage, what the bare minimum should be if you're following the Jesus path and considering getting married. I'd like to think about it this way. When Kristen and I got married, neither of us were into biking. But within a few years of marriage, Kristen had tried it out and it quickly became apparent that this was something that was important to her. This was something she was excited about. And when that happened, some things started to change in our relationship. First of all, she wanted me to get involved, which, to be honest, is a very normal expectation in marriage. When we're passionate about something, it's the most natural thing in the world to want those that we love to share that with us. And so Kristen was excited. I was willing to entertain the idea, even if a little bit reluctant, but she's like, maybe this could be our thing. And I'm like, okay, I'm willing to try it out. And I'll never forget the first time we went to the spandex store. I think they call them bike stores, but they're like spandex stores to me. And we're like, we need the gear. Kristen's like, you need to have the clothes. And so we went and I tried on this pair of spandex shorts and shirts. You can see a picture of me here. And I came out of the dressing room and I'm like, my goodness, this doesn't leave a lot to the imagination here, Kristen. You can see everything virtually. And she's like, no, it's fine. Everybody's got the spandex. And then she said, here, let's ask the salesperson. So she brings over the salesperson. I'll never forget. What is it? You think this looks okay on him? And the salesperson said to me, wow, I think that looks really good on you in the shoulders. In the shoulders? Oh, I was humiliated. That's a backhanded compliment if I've ever had one. Completely ignoring it didn't look good on me basically everywhere else. But I got my spandex. Still, it's a little rocky waters. I got my spandex. And then we got the clip-in pedals. And the first time I tried biking with clip-in pedals, my goodness, I fell off. It was a bit of a rocky road getting sort of used to biking. But occasionally, I was coming along. It was starting to become something I enjoyed. In fact, we ended up watching the Tour de France together one summer. We had a lovely time. And this is the thing, I was willing to dabble in and explore her passion with her, which, to be honest, would be the very first question I would have if I was hypothetically doing the whole marriage thing over again. Is this person willing to explore faith with me? And you know, I'm not talking here about missionary dating or missionary marriages. What I'm talking about is a basic understanding of love. If something is important to Kristen, then it needs to be important to me. And at bare minimum, I should be willing to explore the things that she values. Same with faith. If our faith is important to us, then surely a basic expectation in love and marriage would be a partner who is willing to do the same with us, explore it with us. So that would be my first question in dating someone. Are you willing to explore faith with me? And if they responded, well, I'm just not that interested in faith, my response back would be, well, I kind of hoped you were interested in me. And since faith is a part of my identity and important to me, are you willing to take an interest in that? And if the answer was again, no, I might respond with, well, you don't seem willing to love that part of me. So what parts of me exactly do you love? If someone is truly committed to learning to love in marriage, then I think a bare minimum would be willingness to explore the things that are important to you. But back to the story with Kristen. You see, over time, Kristen was getting better at biking. And to be honest, you know, I like biking. I just don't love it. It wasn't for me, at least not at that competitive level. And so she was on a different level than I was. And for me, it was like, hey, some people, biking is a passion, is a part of their identity. For me, I'm like, yeah, this just isn't my thing. I'm not that passionate about it. Okay, well, what happens then? Well, when I hung up my wheels, so to speak, it meant something needed to shift in our relationship. This wasn't going to be our thing together, but it was still important to Kristen. So what does love require then? Well, for us, it looks like this. You see, I have to intentionally carve out room for Kristen to train and do her bike thing. And so we make that a priority. That means I gotta take the kids, I gotta carve out room in my week to make sure she gets time to pursue a passion of hers. But more than that, love also asks me to invest in her passion as well. And that means at times, instead of gifting her things that I would imagine would be really romantic, at times it means just getting her a new pair of spandex or riding socks. Not my favorite, but I know that speaks her language and I want to invest in that. In addition to that, I think there's something else going on. This, I need to show up when it matters. And sometimes it really does matter. And sometimes this means going out to a race of hers in the freezing cold with three kids and watching her race. But the thing is this, if it's important to her that I'm there, then I need to be there. And you know, biking isn't my thing, but I carve out space for her to pursue it. I invest myself into making sure she can do what she does well, and I show up. And I think those three expectations are applicable, of course, to marriage or thinking about marriage. Is this person willing to carve out space for me to pursue my faith? Is this person willing to invest themselves so that I can live out my faith well? Is this person willing to show up when it matters to me? If I was doing the whole marriage thing all over again, these would be my three expectations. Because sure, maybe your partner did explore faith with you and maybe it just isn't their thing. Fine. But I would expect them to carve out space for me to pursue faith in life. I would expect them to invest themselves into making sure I can give my everything into my faith life. And I would expect them to show up when it matters. And you know, if they weren't willing to do those things, well, I'd probably end it. Because what that would tell me is that they don't share my understanding of what it means to love and what it means to learn to love one another well. And that's not going to work well over a lifetime. Now, I get it. I'm saying this as a matter of hindsight. This is an imagination exercise for me, and I know there's a whole host of other things involved, feelings, falling in love thing, there's all that. But these are things I would consider, at least in my hypothetical dating exercise here. And I know that's easier said than done. But friends, if you're in a position right now where you're considering these questions, at the very least, these questions and ideas are some things to consider if marriage is on your mind right now.